And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when it's worth talking about some of the cases of theft involving the world of sports. No, we're not talking about the cases of betting on baseball, which has hung over Pete Rose and his position that he earned on the diamond in the Hall of Fame, but because he was betting on baseball, that hasn't happened. This also doesn't really directly involve Shohei Ohtani, who's also gotten in trouble because his translator was betting on baseball. It involves what happened to the first home run that Shohei Ohtani hit as a Los Angeles Dodger. It's estimated to be worth $100,000. And the couple that retrieved the home run ball, because it fell very close to where they were sitting out in center field for just such an event, well, they didn't get to keep it. But why not? Because the Dodgers accused of hardball tactics in retrieval of Ohtani's home run. That's what the headline says. We will get to that story. There is also a move by a lot of the top generals in the United States military over several administrations. This is completely bipartisan and very serious. They are demanding changes in what is called the Insurrection Act so that a future president can't take it upon himself or herself to go ahead and send troops into American territory. The Insurrection Act and Congress and the future of a potential second Trump administration, all coming up on the Medved Show. But first off, an extraordinarily significant, it seems to me, column and a very worthwhile contribution to our ongoing discussions about a painful and uncertain situation. The headline, Western Democracy's Future Depends on Israel's Victory. The column is in the Wall Street Journal. It is by Gerard Baker, who writes, if Israel is prevented from defeating Hamas, we should be under no illusions about what it will mean for the future of democracy. If under the pressure of internal democratic politics and global public opinion, the Biden administration forces a ceasefire, in quotes, that leaves our closest ally in the region short of victory over an enemy that seeks to destroy it, sooner or later, we shall all pay the price. This isn't only because Israel is a democratic nation fighting nihilist savages and theocratic tyrants, though it is that. It is because forcing Israel to succumb to moral outrage over the violence that invariably comes with waging war would represent the self-imposition of an inescapable restraint on our own ability to defend ourselves. Of course, Israel is battling above all else for its own survival. In the hostile region, it is also the sole standard bearer of individual freedom, tolerant pluralism, and self-rule. Contrast the condition of ethnic minorities, women, gays, and dissidents in Israel with that of their counterparts anywhere else in the Middle East. We should give thanks every day for the sacrifices Israelis make at the fragile frontier of freedom. Part of what he's talking about is something that I've talked about before, and you probably have noticed as well, is a lot of these people from the extreme left who disrupt sessions of Senate committees and House committees, who interrupt speeches, who protest angrily against anyone speaking in a pro-Israel sphere, those people very often represent so-called progressives who are nonconformists and, yes, sometimes gay and lesbian. And they're speaking in behalf of Islamist crazies who believe that they, as they just passed as a law in Uganda, that people who practice a different form of sexuality, that those individuals deserve the death penalty. It's not something you hear from even ultra-Orthodox Jews or conservative Christians. You do hear it frequently from extreme Muslims. Every Islamist terrorist Israel kills is one fewer threat to the rest of us, writes Gerard Baker, who is, by the way, not Jewish, and he is British originally. He's on his way to becoming an American citizen, and I'm proud that he is. Every Islamist terrorist Israel kills is one fewer threat to the rest of us, he writes. Every setback Israel can deal to the Iranian puppet masters of Hamas, Hezbollah, and others inflicts a loss on the regime that is sworn to eliminate us, the great Satan, and our allies. There is no historical evidence that appeasing enemies committed to our extinction ever keeps us safe. But there's a second sense, writes Baker, in which the future of democracy is at stake in the bloody streets of Gaza. If Israel can somehow be bullied into foregoing victory over this enemy, our own capacity to wage wars inflicted on us will be dramatically diminished. We will have allowed a coalition of armchair media critics, far-left agitators, and Islamist sympathizing activists and governments to hold Israel to a standard no nation taking necessary measures to protect itself would ever be able to meet, a standard to which our enemies will certainly never hold themselves. This reality, he writes, of asymmetric warfare in the age of an all-seeing media and diminished faith in the virtues of our own way of life has been on vivid display in the past week after near universal condemnation of Israel for the deaths of 7 foreign aid workers in a drone attack. A British Army veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq, who now serves as a senior level in the British government, put the event in context. War requires levels of violence and destruction that few truly understand. It requires an acceptance of human suffering among innocents that is unimaginable to most. There is no such thing as a clean war. This one is more visual, but not substantially worse than those I fought in, he said via text messages. We should be clear about what happened last week on the hazy battlefield of Gaza. The tragic error that resulted in the deaths of those brave and innocent souls was heartbreaking, but it was error. If accidents like this are deemed to discredit and delegitimize Israel's war effort, then we can forget about our own ability to take the fight to our enemies when we need to. More coming up on the Michael Medved Show with the latest on the Supreme Court ruling in Arizona.
Here's a special discount, 50% off just for being a MedHead annual member.
You didn't say that.
Join today at michaelmedved.com. More of Michael Medved in a moment. We'll be right back.
And on the Michael Medved Show, I have not read yet the state Supreme Court decision in Arizona that ended up reinstating an 1864 abortion ban, virtually wiping out abortion access in the state. The idea being that the Dobbs case specifically undercut the prevailing law in Arizona. So they went back to this original pre-statehood law from 1864, a law that was passed, 68 years before Arizona was even a state in the Union. It became the 48th state in the United States. Katie Hobbs, who is the governor of Arizona, has now joined virtually everybody, Republican and Democrat, in that state to talk about a need to do something to avoid enforcement of a law in a rapidly growing state where people are divided on the issue of abortion particularly. The Katie Hobbs, the Democratic governor, had this to say about the Supreme Court's decision earlier today. This is clip 12.
It is a dark day in Arizona. Just now, the Arizona Supreme Court issued its opinion in Planned Parenthood v. Mays, upholding one of the most extreme abortion bans in the country. And while it is currently stayed, we continue to live under an unacceptable ban, a law that still strips Arizonans of their personal autonomy and has no exceptions for women who are the victims of rape or incest or any regard for pregnancy complications. Let me be clear. Arizona's 2022 abortion ban is extreme and hurts women. And the near total Civil War era ban that continues to hang over our heads only serves to create more chaos for women and doctors in our state.
Yes, but it incurs opportunities for Democrats, which is why it's entirely possible that they won't move to overturn or to replace the Supreme Court's decision before the election in November, because this does work so well for Democrats. This is remarkable. And the comment is that yesterday, former President Trump put vulnerable House Republicans at ease by stopping short of endorsing a nationwide abortion ban. But the Supreme Court in Arizona, which is entirely composed of Republican-appointed justices, ruled 4-2 that an 1864 law making it a felony to perform an abortion supersedes the 15-week ban that state legislatures passed in 2022. The 19th century law provides exceptions only to save the life of the mother, and it also provides for 2 to 5 years in prison for anybody who assists in an abortion. Representative Juan Ciscomani, a Republican in Arizona who represents a seat President Biden won in 2020, called the ruling, quote, a disaster for women and providers in a statement posted to social media. That's a Republican voice. One of the points here about Trump's statement yesterday, there's a piece in a National Review by the editors that says that first, the good news, Donald Trump's Monday morning statement on abortion reminded pro-lifers that he could turn up the rhetorical heat on Democrats on these issues as he did in the 2016 debates. He said, and we played this for you on the air, President Trump in a video message to the country said Democrats are the radical ones on this position because they support abortion up to and even beyond the 9th month, he said. The concept of having an abortion in the later months and even executions after birth. And he is right that Democrats almost uniformly oppose any legal protection for unborn children at any stage of pregnancy, and right as well that they have sometimes voted against protections even for children who survive attempted abortions. Yeah, but it's misleading to say that they want to legalize infanticide. One thing that they say in this piece in National Review, which I think is true, which is the best way to hit back for Democrats on their extreme position on abortion is that they want you to pay for it. They want taxpayers to fund abortions. And that used to be a position that even Joe Biden opposed. He was in favor of and voted for many times during his long Senate career, the Hyde Amendment, which said that you cannot use taxpayer money to fund abortion simply because a lot of the people who are providing that taxpayer money do not want those funds to be used that way. And I believe that if they actually campaigned Republicans on the idea of making this a who's going to pay for it, again, that's the point about Planned Parenthood. People have the right to contribute to Planned Parenthood all they want to help to pay for contraceptives and, yes, abortions, which are provided by the thousands by Planned Parenthood, to make that all a charity that you can choose to support or not. But when you send taxpayer money in the tens of millions of dollars to Planned Parenthood, what you're doing is using the funds of people who do not support abortion and in many cases passionately oppose it, using those tax funds together with people who would contribute to Planned Parenthood anyway. Basically, the idea of picking and choosing charities to support by the government based upon their ideological arrangement seems to me to be dubious. I'll tell you something else that's dubious. It is our tweet of the day. Oh, it is actually time first for a break. We will get to the tweet of the day, which suggests that sometimes, even when political enemies patch up and make friends, sometimes it isn't that lasting. So what's the problem with a relationship involving the former president of the United States? We'll get to that coming up.
Your whole program is full of hate.
Your daily dose of
hate.
I understand
because
that.
Because you spew hate all afternoon.
It's the Michael Medved Show.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Michael Medved Show, Donald Trump does not take criticism exceptionally well, even when they're from his close associates. And what's interesting about this is Lindsey Graham was already very well established as a politician, a leading voice of the Republican caucus in the Senate, had been a U.S. senator for a decade. At the time that Donald Trump first went down the gold escalator and became involved in politics for the first time ever. And that was when he decided to run in 2016. Yes, he had talked about running in 2012 and in 2000 and other times, but he finally did it in 2016. And he now puts out on his Truth Social, quote, "I blame myself for Lindsey Graham because the only reason he won in the great state of South Carolina is because I endorsed him, and for some reason endorsed has a capital letter. It's preposterous. You can say what you want about Lindsey Graham, and I think that Lindsey was a bit enthusiastic in criticizing Trump's new support for a state-by-state kind of application of abortion regulations. Lindsey Graham criticized it. Trump now is saying again that the only reason Lindsey Graham, who was elected to the Senate, long been elected to the House before that, long before Trump came on the scene. Lindsey Graham was in the House. He was one of the leaders of the impeachment against Bill Clinton. And so you're talking about more than a decade before Trump came on the political scene. And yet he claims the only reason he was elected is because I endorsed him. There's a whole concept of the universe, which is not geocentric, not centered on planet Earth, not heliocentric, not centered on the sun. It is Trumpocentric. And that is the way that the former president sees things. Meanwhile, there is a new project under the heading Former Officials Seek Limits on Power to Deploy Troops on U.S. Soil. And this is a very substantial and substantive, and it seems to me necessary, regardless of who wins the election, it's necessary. A bipartisan group of former senior national security and legal officials, including veterans of the Trump administration, are urging lawmakers to impose new limits on a president's power to deploy federal troops on domestic soil. While it's generally illegal to use the U.S. military for domestic law enforcement purposes, a law called the Insurrection Act grants presidents emergency power to use troops to restore order when they decide a situation warrants it. Legal analysts for decades have proposed overhauling the act, which President George H.W. Bush, at the request of California's governor, last invoked in 1992 to suppress riots in Los Angeles. Those were the Rodney King riots, you may remember. But the weakening, the weakness of existing constraints has taken new salience in the era of former President Donald J. Trump, who has vowed to unilaterally send troops into Democratic cities if he wins the 2024 election. Now, I read that from the New York Times, and I thought, this is impossible. Trump didn't say that. He didn't say he was going to send troops into Democratic cities. But at a rally in Iowa in 2023, President Trump said he would unilaterally send troops into the streets of Democratic-run cities. Quote, you look at any Democrat-run state and it's just not the same. It doesn't work, Trump said, calling cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and San Francisco crime dens. Quote, we cannot let it happen any longer. And one of the other things I'll do, because you're supposed to not be involved in that, you just have to be asked by the governor, the mayor, to come in. The next time, I'm not waiting. That is a pretty clear implication that he would send the troops in anyway, even though he is not requested by the mayor or the governor. There's a film coming out at the end of this week. We're going to be reviewing it. I've seen it. It's a film called Civil War. And basically, it presents a nightmare, and it's a nightmarish, very disturbing film about what a civil war that people romanticize about in the United States in the 21st century could look like. Would that kind of struggle be the result of the last day of the session before the 2-week Easter recess, that recently resigned Republican Ken Buck blasted Marge Green today, asserting that she gets her talking points from the Kremlin and only cares about social media engagement and attention. On the last day of the session before the 2-week Easter recess, which is now over, of course, Congress is back, Green filed a motion to vacate against Speaker Mike Johnson after he reached a bipartisan budget deal with Democrats. And there is this amazing statement about Marjorie Taylor Greene, about why she is so determined to block any aid to Ukraine. Listen.
From the Russian people, just like you said, well, that's pretty much illegal. They're having a lot of problems with that. And Europe does not want to do it. And that's where most of those assets are. But let's talk about what this really is, Steve. This is a war on Christianity. The Ukrainian government is attacking Christians. The Ukrainian government is executing priests. Russia is not doing that. They're not attacking Christianity. As a matter of fact, they seem to be protecting it. So that's something else that's clear and obvious to many people that are looking closely at what's going on.
Okay, it is clear and obvious to no one because it's not true. The idea that this is a war on Christianity, that is why Ukraine is fighting against a Russian invasion of their country. Did Ukraine invade Russia in order to attack Christianity? Here is how Ken Buck, former representative, characterized what Marjorie Taylor Greene had to say.
My experience with Marjorie is people have talked to her about not filing articles of impeachment on President Biden before he was sworn into office, on not filing articles of impeachment that were groundless on other individuals in the Biden administration. And she was never moved by that. She was always focused on her social media account. And Moscow Marjorie is focused now on this Ukraine issue and getting her talking points from the Kremlin and making sure that she is popular and she is getting a lot of coverage.
Okay, that's Moscow Marjorie. And in terms of other struggles, what about the struggle over a $100,000 baseball? This got my attention because it came at the same time that there is a burglary ring that has been seizing priceless sports memorabilia from small museums on the eastern seaboard of the United States. Okay, how does that work? And with Shohei Ohtani, who really is just beginning his career, is his home run ball really worth that much money? We will get to that and more coming up on the MedVet Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, reminding you that we have a new podcast just posted on Substack. It's about putting the year of eclipses and earthquakes into context. And some of the messages, religious, apocalyptic messages that people have taken from the earthquake and from the eclipse yesterday, which I think is fascinating and actually relates to something else in American history, which was the year of meteors, which was the year that Abraham Lincoln, against all expectations, ascended to the presidency. Check it out at michaelmedved.substack.com. That's Michael Medved, M-E-D-V as in victory, E-D, .substack.com. Meanwhile, speaking of victory, there is a story from the world of sports, Dateline Los Angeles. It all happened so quickly for Ambar Roman, a lifelong Dodgers fan. She watched as her husband dived to the ground with others to search for Shohei Ohtani's home run ball in Dodger Stadium on last Wednesday night. Now, this was a significant home run because it was the first one that Ohtani hit as a Dodger, and given the fact that he led the American League in home runs last year, it was expected that there would be many, 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 many home runs. And so the ball was considered extremely valuable. Then Ambar Roman, the lady in this couple, looked down near her feet, and there it was. She picked up the ball, Ohtani's milestone first homer with the Dodgers, and she pumped her fist. As is customary with a significant home run ball, there is a negotiation between the team and the fan who catches it. The fan will generally receive memorabilia and have a meet and greet with the player in exchange for a ball that represents a meaningful personal achievement. In this case, however, Roman and her husband say members of the Dodger Stadium security staff separated them and pressured her and left them little choice but to hand over the baseball for what they considered a low-ball offer. The Dodgers initially dangled two caps signed by Ohtani in exchange for a ball that an auction house representative later said would be worth at least $100,000. We're not trying to extort anybody. It's not that we're money hungry, said her husband. And it's just that it's a special moment. It's a special ball. I just think it's fair for us to be equally rewarded. I was just disappointed that a team that I hold so dear pulled a quick one on us. The Dodgers have a memorabilia store at the club level of the ballpark. It offers an autographed foul ball hit by Ohtani in 2021 for nearly $15,000. $15,000 for a foul ball? The Los Angeles Times reported the price provides a barometer for the value of Ohtani's first home run ball. The ball's value at a minimum is $100,000, said Chris Ivey, director of sports auctions at Heritage Auctions. However, they would need authentication to be sold this ball. And the couple said they did not receive authentication or confirmation that Ohtani actually signed them. The Dodgers will now authenticate the couple's merchandise. That's two bats and two caps. Where was the Dodger love that we see every day, every time we go? The Romans said. It just disappeared. We were kind of left stranded. It's not necessarily that we wanted a million, just something nice. Take care of your fans, especially when they got something that's way more valuable. The question about the value, it's assuming that Shohei Ohtani is going to be in the Hall of Fame, that he's going to have a great, great career. He's not pitching this year. He's playing, well, mostly designated hitter, apparently. And if his career doesn't turn out to be so golden, then would the value of $100,000 actually go down? Meanwhile, speaking about values going down, there is a new analysis of President Trump's delay efforts in dealing with his various trials and accusations and indictments and court dates. CNN legal analyst Norm Eisen talked about that delaying tactic. This is clip four.
It's to be expected. In fact, in my book coming out this week, Trying Trump, about this case, I predicted that Trump would attempt to use this action. It's known as a Section 230 motion. You go directly to the appellate court, not the trial judge. You say, hey, too much pretrial publicity, move this case. Of course he was going to try it. By my count, it's his ninth delay tactic, Wolf, because he's very nervous about facing a jury on these allegations of election interference. But it wasn't going to work because Donald Trump himself is responsible for so much of the pretrial publicity. The judge also released a very detailed juror questionnaire today, where jurors are going to be asked about dozens of potential sources of knowledge about the case. And using that questionnaire and then interrogating the jurors in that courtroom is how you will screen for bias, not moving the case. It was a dead loser from the get-go.
Okay, he's talking about the ongoing upcoming case about the hush money and the misleading and fraudulent way in which the hush money was reported. That's what the case that is going to be beginning in New York next week. There is also a big new movie set entirely in New York, and a movie with Sean Penn that has artistic aspirations. It's about the tough lives of people who work as paramedics for a living. Listen.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
Sean Penn stars as a veteran paramedic working for the New York Fire Department who tries to show the ropes to a newcomer and aspiring doctor who's overwhelmed by the blood, guts, and ugliness that are part of his new work in Asphalt City.
I know what you're thinking. Is it worth it?
It's the job.
You all work in the darkness. You don't gotta let it inside you.
But there's nothing but darkness in this brutal, deeply disturbing, and often very powerful film. It's based on a novel called Black Flies, with focus on wounds, cruelty, criminality, and sacrifice, and on deep sympathy for the people who work as emergency medical technicians. It's rated a very hard R, with nightmarishly vivid visions of suffering and death. The pitch-dark, monochromatic tone of this thriller limits the ambitious film's emotional impact. 2.5 stars for Asphalt City. It's tough to forget and also difficult to praise. And on the Michael Medved Show, I have no trouble at all praising Mike Pence. And in fact, I'm going to be with him at a conference on anti-Semitism that's being convened by Paul Kangor at Grove City College tomorrow. And